couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to war with The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1. We're going to be talking about The Theory of Everything with The Theory of Everything. We're going to be talking about VHS Viral, again, another horror movie not released in October, and Rosewater, Jon Stewart's directorial debut. But first, we're going to be talking about some news. We're going to have the trailer park. Later in the show, we're going to have listener feedback and box office predictions and the world-famous DVD roundup. But before we get to all that, let's talk about how to get in touch with me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to interact with me on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr. Let's move on.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
All right, Ron Burgundy, let's talk about the news real quick. A little note, Mike Nichols, rest in peace. The legendary director passed away on November 19th at age 83. He, of course, directed The Graduate. And, you know, a whole ton of movies. He was even directing not too long ago into movies like Closer, even though I didn't like Closer. That was a big movie for him. He had an illustrious career. He did a lot of things. And he oversaw a lot of changes through filmmaking over the years. So it's sad to see him go. Another bit of, I don't want to talk too much about Interstellar because I've hammered away at that for the last 2 weeks. But I do want to point out that Christopher Nolan has responded to the sound criticism that people have had with the fact that they couldn't hear the dialogue over the music. And his response is basically, well, I meant to do it that way. The dialogue's not important. It's about the music and it's about the scene and the tone. And to me, that's the most pretentious answer you can get. Well, I meant to do it that way. And I think it was Scott Mendelson at Forbes who said it the best, where he says, look, if there's dialogue that characters are having in a movie, you should at least let the audience in on the conversation. And look, Christopher Nolan can do whatever he wants. That's fine. If he can get the studio to allow him to do whatever he wants, that's great. I'm just questioning whether it was a smart move. And what's hilarious about it, I had made a comment on Twitter, a couple of them. One of the ones I did was, I said, breaking news, Christopher Nolan doesn't care about dialogue. And another one was, I took a clip from Pee Wee Herman's Big Adventure where he's sort of showing off on his bike and he hits a curb and he falls and rolls in front of a bunch of other kids in front of the bike. And he's like, I meant to do that. And I said, that's basically what it sounds like. And suddenly I got like this bunch of hate, Twitter hate, on one of the nights. I think it was Tuesday night, from some Nolan fanboy. And the guy was a real jerk about it. He said, well, you didn't read the article. And I'm like, yeah, no, I did read the article. And it wasn't a good excuse. He goes, I still don't think you read the article. I'm adding the voice inflection there. And I found out the reason why I suddenly got Twitter hate days after I tweeted this. Apparently I was quoted in a CNN article about this. Now, there was a time when I was quoted in CNN, but I actually got a phone call from CNN. But this shows just the laziest journalism that's out there. They just found a tweet and they put my tweet in their story, which is completely legitimate. But it's also the laziness of writing in news nowadays. They go find what people's tweet, like whenever a celebrity dies, you know, like when Paul Walker died, they find, oh, this is what Twitter's saying about it. Alyssa Milano tweeted out, I'm so sad to see him go, or something like that. That's lazy journalism. Just pick up the phone. At the very least, send an email. Get a real quote. But still, it was nice to be quoted on CNN. One other piece of news that I kind of ignored it over the last couple weeks, but it's really spiraling big. I just kind of want to weigh in on it. It's marginally connected to movies. The whole Bill Cosby scandal. I haven't delved heavily into the story because it's all accusation. And it seems to be in development now. It's also nothing new. These accusations have been around for dozens of years. I mean, look, if people have a grievance against Bill Cosby and this happened, take it up with him. And that's fine. I don't think you have much of a legal place to stand if you're claiming assault like 30 years ago. You have a much harder hill to climb. But, you know, hey, if you believe this happened, by all means, accuse. But what bothers me isn't the accusations that are happening. It's the people's response. And we saw this with Woody Allen, who I think's a creep. And we saw this with Bryan Singer this summer when he was accused of sexual assault. There are these stories that are years or decades old that are coming out, and it's the public reaction response. I've seen people make comments to the effect of, well, we should believe the victims when they say this. And I'm like, sure, we need to take the accusation seriously. But an accusation does not mean it's true. And here's the problem with something like they're accusing Bill Cosby of rape and sexual assault. What makes it rape and sexual assault is whether or not there was consent at the time. And there's no way to prove that. There just plain isn't. Now, you can show us pattern of behavior, and that's what they're trying to talk about doing. And in fact, 10 years ago, there was somebody who came out and accused him, and a bunch of other women were like, well, we'll testify if this goes to trial. And they ended up settling that. I saw somebody post on Facebook something to the effect of, we need to treat these accusers and believe them from the beginning. And I'm like, no, you don't. From a legal standpoint, you shouldn't. The last thing we want in this country is a justice system that believes an accuser with no form of trial. You don't want that as a legal precedent. And that makes it awful because it's very, very hard to prove this stuff. And you don't want to make it easier to prove it because then it would rely on just word against word. And there's tons of people who you can't believe word against word. If he had settled these, like when he settled 10 years ago, I mean, maybe he settled because it was true and he wanted to pay hush money. Maybe he settled because he knew there was no way to win this in the court of public opinion. And that's fine. If you want to think Bill Cosby's a rapist, you are more than welcome to believe that. But the law can't look at it that way. And that's the problem. I think there are people who want to change that about the law. Proving rape's extremely hard, especially if it's like acquaintance or date rape. It just is hard to prove. Because what makes it rape is consent or not consent. Who knows what was going on? Nobody knows except Cosby and whoever's making the accusations. I always find that it's suspect when you have allegations that are 20, 30 years old. That's what I always find. I find that suspect. If it happens immediately, if he was accused of rape in 1982, that would have a much bigger impact. But now, I don't know. I don't know what happened. And I'm not defending Cosby. Maybe the guy's horrible. I don't know. But I'm not immediately believing him, or I'm not immediately believing the accusers. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Finish talking about Bill Cosby, and let's talk real quick as we move on into the trailer park. Two trailers I want to highlight today. The first one is Pitch Perfect 2. Which is, of course, the sequel to Pitch Perfect, which came out 2 years ago. Very funny movie, the first one. The sequel is coming out May 15th.
The World Championships of Acapella, where every 4 years, the best from around the globe compete for world domination. No American team has ever won.
That's because they hate us.
The whole world.
The whole world hates us. Hate us.
Every Bella must christen the house by sliding down the staircase.
Let me show you.
Crushed it.
Here's the problem when you have such an unexpectedly great movie like Pitch Perfect, which was a lot of fun, very funny, wildly entertaining. It's doing a follow-up. It's gotten a bigger release date. It's May 15th. It's opening in the middle of the summer, pre-Memorial Day. This is a big release. There's a certain American Pie 2 feel to this movie. From the trailers, I don't get a sense of story. I don't get a sense of anything more than just them trying to retread some stuff and just make it bigger and do more songs. Are they going to gleeify the movie and just make it half of it is just singing covers? Part of what made the first one so original and cool is that it was fresh. I'm skeptical whether they're keeping that for this one. The next trailer I want to talk about is The Age of Adeline. I saw this trailer in front of the Hunger Games. This opens on April 24th.
The next time we see each other, I'll have a new identity. I'll always be your mother, and I'll always be my daughter. Happy birthday, Mama.
You look exactly like this old friend of mine. We were very close.
Don't you miss having someone to love?
It's not the same when there's no growing old together. Without that love is just heartbreak.
You've got Blake Lively playing a woman who doesn't age. I think it's trying to go off the Benjamin Button crowd. This movie looks okay. I just don't buy Blake Lively in sort of this heavy dramatic performance because I don't think she's a good actor at all. She's very pretty. I don't think she's a good actor. Comes out in April. So, I mean, who knows? It could be a good movie. But I just don't buy her in this movie. I don't buy her in the trailer. She's like, bleh. Very pretty, but doesn't act at all. All right, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about The Theory of Everything and Rosewater.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies with Kevin Carr. We are rolling into the movie review portion of the program. The first one I want to talk about is something I've always been interested in, and that is science and Stephen Hawking. And I followed Stephen Hawking ever since I was in high school, really. I was in high school in the 80s, and that's when he was really sort of growing to prominence and emerged from just a guy who worked in Cambridge and was a smart guy that nobody really knew about to suddenly being this science celebrity. You only have a handful of these science celebrities that come along. You had Carl Sagan was obviously one of them. The big one now is Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Stephen Hawking is one of them. And what's so fascinating about Stephen Hawking just as a person is he's such a genius, such a brilliant mind, and he's trapped in this body that's ravaged by this disease that has completely destroyed his muscular function. And what's interesting is if you watch Errol Morris's Brief History of Time, which is sort of this amalgamation of theories from Hawking's book and a bit of a documentary on his life, you actually find out that it is because of this disease that allowed him to focus solely on his genius work. Otherwise, he just sort of like sloughed his way through school. He was so smart, he didn't have to work very hard. And it was when he was saddled with this muscular disease that he really turned inward and, I mean, sharpened his brain to an amazing ability. This guy's smarter than almost anybody on the planet. Except me, of course. No, I'm an idiot. Anyways, The Theory of Everything, the life, marriage, career, and ailment of genius professor Stephen Hawking is examined in this biopic.
It's called motor neuron disease. Life expectancy is 2 years.
The brain. What about the brain?
The brain isn't affected. Your thoughts won't change. It's just no one will know what they are.
I know what you'll think, that I don't look like a terribly strong person, but I love him. He loves me. We're going to fight this illness together.
This does feel very much like an Oscar bait kind of movie. And it is. I mean, it's the guy who plays Stephen Hawking, Eddie Murnane, he's going to get an Oscar nomination. It's already out there. There's people saying that's going to be one of the top five. But not to be reduced, Felicity Jones, who I've always had a thing for. I've always kind of liked Felicity Jones. I think she's adorable. But she does a really good job in this movie, too, because there's a lot of meat for her to work with. She plays Jane Hawking, who's his wife. And while it's a lot of her reacting to the situation Stephen Hawking's in, there's some meat to her character. She's just not the wife. There's a lot going on. And the two of them were essential to this development of him and his career and his life, really. I mean, the guy was given 2 years to live. He's still alive and kicking. He's got to be at least as old as Bill Cosby. And I don't think he sexually assaulted anybody. Theory of Everything is a very well-made movie. It's less about science and more about the character and the personal struggles that he had to go through and the unique situation when you have your entire skeletal musculature falling apart and not working, what he had to go through, what she had to go through, the interpersonal drama that happened with them, it really is. It's a beautiful movie. It really, really is. One thing it also does is by the time people knew who Stephen Hawking was when he published his book, A Brief History of Time, which is sort of covered in this movie. But of course, it happened long after he had been doing research at Cambridge. And I remember when Brief History of Time came out, it was such a pop book to read. And it's a good book. If you haven't read it, it's a good book because it distills these really dense, complex scientific theories into a very understandable, digestible narrative. He's a good writer. I don't know if he had anybody help him with it, but he presents it extremely well. He's actually a better writer than Carl Sagan was when he wrote Cosmos, which is a little harder to read, which came out 10 years before that. Hawking kind of came out of nowhere, and everyone was reading Brief History of Time. I remember seeing interviews with like Kim Basinger reading Brief History. I'm like, why do we care what Kim Basinger's? Why do we care that she read a book about black holes? I mean, really, seriously. I mean, it would be the equivalent of today asking Snooki if she read Stephen Hawking's book. I don't care whether, you know, like Snooki or Kim Kardashian or anybody had read Stephen Hawking. I'm certain they don't understand it. Because even as well as he distills it for the average person, these people on reality TV are absolute idiots. So I don't care what they say. But it was a pop thing. Everybody was reading it. And I remember I bought a copy late 80s, early 90s, because I wanted to read it. And it was a fantastic book. And it's a fantastic story, just his story in general. So, I don't know, I kind of rambled through that review. My apologies. It's a great movie. It's very well done. It's going to be remembered throughout award season. Fantastic performances by the actors involved. Fantastic direction by James Marsh. This is really a good movie. I'm saying that the theory of everything totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Rosewater. This is Jon Stewart's directorial debut. A journalist is imprisoned in Iran for 118 days under suspicion of being a spy.
I'm a journalist. I'm covering the elections for Newsweek magazine.
Don't you want to report the other side?
We are the educated.
So you're a student?
We are the educated.
Tensions are rising in Iran.
The election has ended in controversy.
What are you doing? Fighting back! You gotta get killed! Come on!
You have a real weapon and you choose not to use it.
Sir, can you tell me why I'm here?
That's what happens to foreign spies caught on Iranian soil.
The story is about BBC journalist Mazer Bahari. Now, he's an Iranian-born, and he was a Canadian citizen. And he was covering the election, and during the election, he was interviewed by The Daily Show. You know, The Daily Show doesn't take themselves seriously, so they're asking silly questions, and they're making jokes about being a spy, and that was one of the things that they used against this guy, because when the election sort of went sour and people were saying election fraud, it made them start looking at him, and here's a broadcast on American television suggesting he's a spy, which is, spies wouldn't do that for real. So I don't know what the Iranians were smoking. And I think there was a certain level of guilt that Jon Stewart had for this. And so he made this movie based on this guy's book. Now, it's an interesting enough movie because I remember the election in Iran 5 years ago. And I remember somewhat of this news story about a captive in prison. But I really didn't know the full ins and outs of the story. And I think it's fascinating because while it presents Iran as a dangerous place to have free thought, it doesn't make it into this crazy terrorist hub where everybody is in a burqa chained to a fence or anything like that. It makes Iran look like just a regular everyday country, which it is, but it does have certain leadership problems and censorship and that sort of thing. So I think that gives an interesting perspective on the world. The problem is the movie just reeks of first-time director. I mean, it's Jon Stewart doing his first chance, and he overuses certain cinematic techniques. Half the movie is this guy in a cell, basically. It's very hard to make that compelling, and he tries. But this is one of those movies that would have been a better movie if he had directed one or two before this. It just seemed like he was a little out of his depth and he pulled his punches and it didn't seem as distressful as it could have been. Also, it stars Gael Garcia Bernal as Bahari. And Bernal is Mexican. And I know I'm getting into this whole sort of racial profiling thing, but he doesn't really look Iranian. And I've seen him in so many movies where he's playing within his own race, the boundaries of his own race, that it's not convincing at all. And it does sort of bring the question of sort of racist casting of saying, well, that guy's got brown skin. Let's put him in the movie. It doesn't matter if he's from Mexico. He's an Iranian now. I'm going to have to say that Rosewater kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Okay. That's all I have to say about those movies. I need to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the big movie of the weekend, The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1, and then VHS Viral. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. We are going to war. We're starting a revolution. That's right. We're not really. I'm way too lazy to start any revolution. I can barely get off the couch to let my dog in the house. That is how lazy I am. I am a lazy, lazy person. What's my job? My job is to sit my butt in a movie theater and watch movies. And then sit on my butt and tell people what I think about them. It's the laziest job on the planet. It's awesome. But I have to admit, it's a lazy job. I mean, it's not like a professional football player where you got to keep in shape. I get a shape. I keep in a shape. It's round. Anyways, let's talk about The Hunger Games, Mockingjay, Part 1. The first half of The Last Hunger Game books comes to life with Katniss whining about PETA and being used as a propaganda puppet.
I never wanted any of this. I never wanted to be in the games. I just wanted to save my sister and keep PETA alive.
Miss Everdeen, it's the things we love most that destroy us.
PETA is the Capitol's weapon, the same way you're ours.
You will rescue PETA at the earliest opportunity, or you will find another Mockingjay.
As if you couldn't tell by my blurb of the movie, I have some issues with it. I remember I was talking to my wife when she first read the story, because my wife read all three Hunger Games books, and she loved them. And when it was announced that they're going to split this into two, even my wife, who loved the movies and loved like Twilight, she's like, that's not going to work. There's not enough for two movies in this book. You can pretty much get one movie out of it. But they're splitting it because it worked for Harry Potter. It worked for the Twilight series. Why not do it for the Hunger Games? Let's get more money out of this franchise. Even my wife, who will see as many movies as they'll make for a franchise she loves, she still was even like, yeah, this isn't a great idea. And that's the biggest problem with this movie. I mean, it's the setup of the book. And I remember saying about Catching Fire, my problem with Catching Fire was all in that first act, because when they were back in the districts, they had to keep reminding you, hey guys, there's a love triangle between Peter and Gale. Just you're hammering it in. And once the Hunger Gaming started in Catching Fire, it was actually pretty good. It really was a strong movie. But it was that getting through that first act, and that's essentially what this movie is. It's Kat whining. She's got PTSD, and she's waking up with nightmares, and there's a lot of meetings with her and the president of District 13 and of the Revolution, and with Plutarch there, as you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman in one of his final roles. It's just a lot of talking, and then there's a lot of talking with Gale, and Gale, he's played by Liam Hemsworth. Liam, my brother is Thor Hemsworth. It's ironic that Chris Hemsworth this week was called the sexiest man alive. Is it People magazine that is sexiest man alive? And his brother's got the blockbuster movie coming out. Nobody cares about Liam Hemsworth. I think Liam Hemsworth is colossally boring. Chris Hemsworth has spark to him. There's none. I've seen several movies with Liam Hemsworth, not just the Hunger Games film. I saw that Last Song with Miley Cyrus. He was in The Expendables 3, and he was in that movie Paranoia. He's terrible in everything. He's not bad. No, he's not terrible. He's not bad. He's just boring. There's nothing compelling about him. He's like very white bread kind of background. He's just, meh, who cares? He's like Armie Hammer. He's just like, meh. I don't think he's very good. And so you've got that. You've got her sister and her mom, who are boring as well. And they're in this movie, of course, because they got rescued into District 13. The thing that saves this movie is Jennifer Lawrence throws down, and she does a really good job with the role. And she has some great speeches, and there's some very emotional moments. And you've also got some other fantastic actors. You know, Donald Sutherland, unfortunately, he's only in like three scenes. But Donald Sutherland is there as President Snow, the bad guy. You've got Julianne Moore as the president of District 13, and she does a really good job. Phil Seymour Hoffman does a really good job. Katniss's team, like Natalie Dormer. I mean, they're good. There's a lot of good people working on this movie. The problem is, it's not even a complete movie. It's barely half a movie. It's like the first act. A good chunk of this movie is just people whining, and Katniss is whining and complaining, and she's suffering from PTSD. They're padding it out because they need to make it reach 2 hours. So instead of having like one scene of her waking up with nightmares, we got two. Instead of having one scene of her walking up and seeing the rubble and the destruction that the Capitol has caused on a district, we've got like three of those. Instead of seeing one scene where she's talking about how much she wants to protect PETA, we've got three scenes. And this would be like if you were watching, say, Return of the Jedi, and it ends when they get to the Ewok village. And we got to wait to the next one. That's the other problem with it, is the last movie was very powerful and left a great cliffhanger. We're still on the cliff. This movie doesn't do anything to get us off that cliff. This movie is marking time. It is a bloated, padded out, boring movie that has these spikes of interest. And there's some interesting political things going on. They're talking about propaganda and how they're running this revolution and how Katniss is no longer, I mean, she's a symbol now, and she's important. She's more important than other people who are dying. And I mean, there's a certain smartness to that, but it's just all glossed over for the, I love PETA, we gotta save him. Which just goes forever. And then some pretty colossally stupid decisions by people who should be way smarter. But ultimately, you get to the end of the movie and you're like, that was kind of a waste of 2 hours. It's for that reason that I say The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
Maybe Mockingjay as a whole would have been better. This movie felt like they had like an hour film and then they just threw back a bunch of deleted scenes. You ever watch deleted scenes on a DVD? And they all, you usually can watch them and be like, oh yeah, I know why they got rid of that. That was unnecessary. No, all those scenes are in there. It's like 45 extra minutes of deleted scenes just inserted back into the movie and then ended in the middle. Maybe as a whole, the movie would be good, but there's so much just added to this movie that just makes it boring, which is sad because I like the first two Hunger Games movies. All right, you're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is VHS Viral, the third found footage anthology horror movie featuring four grisly tales of unexpected terror.
Where did you find that tape?
A secret compartment. He recorded everything.
See you on YouTube.
Welcome to the show.
Oh my God, turn it off. Not funny.
Keep going, keep going. We could edit that out.
I was a huge fan of VHS and VHS 2. And that's important to note because anyone who knows me and has listened to the show knows that I freaking hate found footage. I am so done with the found footage genre. I think it's been overused and overworked and it doesn't tell creative stories and it's just an excuse to get around narrative issues. I hate it as a whole. But overall, the VHS movies I actually thought were really pretty good, partly because I also love anthology horror. And the first two VHS movies really made them essential to that camera point of view. And if you've seen those movies, you'll see, well, it makes sense. These were things that were caught on tape. Like one of them, I think, is in VHS 2. This guy has an ocular implant, and it's told from being recorded on the guy's ocular implant. Well, that makes sense. There's another episode where these people are running into a house and trying to document it as ghost hunters. Well, I'm like, well, that makes sense for them to have the cameras. VHS Viral is not as good as the other two VHS movies. And part of the reason for that is it's getting away from the reason why things need to be found footage. There's a couple episodes. In particular, there's one. It's the first full-length story in there. There's a wraparound story, and then there's this full-length one. And it's about a magician who has real powers. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, well, it's an interesting movie and a very cool concept. And it, as a story, it's a really cool story. But there's parts in there where I'm like, who the heck's videotaping this? I know, because some of them, it's like, oh, it's the camera on some like SWAT team's helmet, or somebody has their own video camera that they're documenting. But there's several points where I'm like, well, where's this camera? How did that footage even originate, and who's handling the camera because it's moving? So the first two are pretty cool. They're very cool in sort of a Twilight Zone kind of old horror movie magazine story, and the first two tell some really cool stories. The third one, not so much. It's a GoPro camera, and I'm just those are nauseating, and there's not a whole lot of uniqueness to it. And then the fourth one is very, very short, and it's an interesting little idea, and they get in and they get out and they do it, and it's a neat little blip. And then the wraparound story is completely confusing. So it's not as strong as the other two VHS movies, but it's still pretty decent. It's one of the best found footage movies you're going to see, but it's distanced itself from the actual need for a found footage movie. There needs to be a little more thought put into how this all ties together. I'm going to say VHS Viral kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Kevin Carr wrapping up the discussion on this week's movies. Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's move on out of the movie reviews since we got through all four of those, and let's talk about some listener feedback. This comes from my good friend Red State Gabe way out in Arizona. It is a general question about writing screenplays, so it's not necessarily about movies that are out there, but here it is. He says, if someone writes a novel or short story to be published concerning a suspense/drama set in the Las Vegas Strip, can that person mention the casino's actual names? Are there royalties involved when actual landmark hotels and casino names are referenced in fiction, or can one of these places be the setting free of charge? Well, depending on what you're doing, you're going to have different hoops you got to jump through. I'm assuming that Red State Gabe is writing us either a story or a novel or a screenplay, and it's very small. It's not commissioned by a studio or anything like that. If you're just writing it for yourself and you're going to maybe self-publish on Amazon, or you're just going to have this short story that you maybe try and sell to a magazine, or you just want to write a screenplay, you are probably fine with just mentioning it as a location. You don't need to get the right to reference locations, because they're real locations. It's like you can have something happen at the Sears Tower in Chicago. You don't have to pay anybody for that, any more than you have to pay the city of Las Vegas to set the movie in Las Vegas. Where it can be a little dicey is if you are implying or saying that this location is directly having something that's not true and defaming to its character. Now, first of all, this is not legal advice at all. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just saying, from what I understand, having written stuff and published stuff myself, you can have it take place wherever. But like, for example, if you had to take place at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, and the people on the board were using the Wynn to take over the country or do something really dastardly or wrong, or you were seeing Wayne Newton at whatever he plays, or David Copperfield at Caesar's Palace, and you actually make them a character and have them doing something as a bad guy, you can't do that. You can say they went to go see David Copperfield, but you can't suddenly make David Copperfield a character. And you can't make the people that actually run the casinos characters, and you can't make them bad guys. You can create, if you want to imply that the MGM Grand is like laundering money for the mob, you may have some problems with that. But if you're just like, oh, there's a waitress at the MGM Grand, and she falls in love with a Pai-Gao dealer, okay, well then that's fine, because it's just the setting. You can reference, you can talk about landmarks or whatever, as long as you're not, I guess, implicating the landmark or the corporation or a person in a defamation thing. And I mean, you could do it and just roll the dice that nobody cares. There's that movie that came out last year, Escape from Tomorrow, which took a shot in Walt Disney. And you get the DVD, not just the movie, but if you get the DVD, there's a whole discussion on the legality of doing that. And they shot in Walt Disney World, and they're like, well, it's a public place. And I mean, Walt Disney could come in and say, you can't show these things because those are trademarked. But they would have a hard time confiscating the footage or saying you can't use this footage as long as it doesn't have a trademarked image on it. And then would it be worth Disney's trouble? And Disney just didn't go after the guys who made that movie, because they would give more attention to it, the Streisand effect. So you can do that. You can have something take place at Walt Disney World, but you can't have the chairman of Walt Disney be the murderer. That's what you can't do, if that makes sense. So I hope that answers your question. So go ahead and write the story. Just, you know, if that's the setting, it's the setting. You know, and if you're going to do anything that's overly intricate, now you can have like a jerk manager who gives a problem to the waitress or something like that. But you're fine with that, because you're not implicating the hotel or casino. You're not implicating like Caesar's Palace. So I hope that answers your question. If it becomes popular enough, if you do this screenplay and then Paramount wants to buy it and make a movie out of it, let them worry about the legalities. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. And last week, was I correct? I said that Big Hero 6 was going to win with $33 million. I was really close, because it did come in number two with $34.7 million. But Dumb and Dumber 2 did better than I expected. It made $36 million itself. So it was actually, people were predicting throughout the weekend that it was going to be closer to 40, but it didn't end up doing that. But still, $36 million for Dumb and Dumber 2. Pretty good for a movie whose first installment came out 20 years ago. Now, it was a cheap movie to make. The budget was pretty small, comparatively. I don't know what the exact budget was, but I heard that it was, you know, probably $35 million or so. Now, this was, of course, not made in the heyday of Jim Carrey. If it was Jim Carrey 15 years ago, it would have cost a lot more. But Jim Carrey is not commanding $20 million salaries anymore, so you can make Dumb and Dumber 2. I mean, it did well. I didn't particularly like it, but hey, nostalgia works sometimes. And this may end up ushering in, it's already ushering, we've got like a Joe Dirt sequel. Why are we have a Joe Dirt sequel? And was anyone asking for this aside from David Spade? So yeah, we might get these 90s sequels coming back. I don't know how long they'll last. Until we get two or three of them that bomb in a row, they'll stop making them. But yeah, then Big Hero 6 almost beat it. Interstellar was at $28 million. It's made $96 million as coming out of last weekend. It's still tracking about $10 to $15 million less than Big Hero 6, which is kind of interesting. Beyond the Lights did pretty well with $6.2 million, which is good for how much that movie cost. It had a budget of like $7 million. And then Rosewater actually opened last week and it came in 13th. This week, I mean, it's obviously going to be Mockingjay that wins. But there's a little bit of interesting things going on. The first Hunger Games opened with $152 million in March, opening weekend, which is unheard of. And then when they did the Hunger Games Catching Fire, which came out last Thanksgiving, it was $158 million. No 3D bump, but it did have an IMAX bump. This movie's not going to top that. I guarantee you it's not going to top it. It's not going to be $160 million. That's insane. It also doesn't have the IMAX screen, so it's less of an event. Those are all going to still Interstellar and the bad sound mix for that. I think that Mockingjay Part 1 is going to play very soft. I think it's going to play more like a Twilight film than the Hunger Games movies. And the reason for that is it's not about the Hunger Games. And there's not a whole lot that's going on in it. I think people are smarter than Hollywood sometimes gives them credit for. I think the people are like, oh, they're not going to race out to go see another Hunger Games movie that doesn't have anything to do with the Hunger Games and is only half a movie. I think there's a lot of people that are just going to wait till it comes to video and then watch it before they go see the finale next year. The next year should do pretty well. But I think this one's going to play soft. I think it's going to be extremely front-loaded. And it all depends on how front-loaded it is, because the last two Hunger Games movies made like $70 million on their first day. And this one could do that. But it wasn't the first day. It was what happens throughout the weekend. The Twilight movies, half of their weekend box office came on that preview shows in that first day. I mean, there's one that was like, I think one of the Breaking Dawn movies, it had like a $70 million opening day, and it was actually, it like closed that weekend with $138 million. It didn't even double what its first day was. It's extremely front-loaded. I think you're going to get that with this movie. I think this one's going to be good for about $125 million, maybe more, but it's certainly not going to break $150 million. It's definitely not going to break $160 million. I'm thinking $125 to $130 million tops. So we'll see. If it goes much lower than that, that's a bad... It's a good sign for cinema, because then they'll just stop splitting movies into two when it's unnecessary. But it'll be a bad sign for The Hunger Games. And I don't know if they're going to burn off any demand from this for the next film. It's getting decent reviews, but I don't know. It's getting less decent reviews than the last two. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. There's an interesting swash of movies out this week. There's 22 Jump Street on DVD and Blu-ray. That was fun. Not as good as the original, or the first. Not the original, the first one. But, you know, hey, for a sequel, it wasn't bad. Then there's Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, which wasn't a bad sequel in itself, but it was just too little too late. I mean, it was almost 9 years between the release of this and the previous Sin City. If they would have made this 3-4 years after the first one, as opposed to 9, it probably would have done better. And it's a decent enough movie, but it's just sort of like it seems its time has come and gone. And So It Goes is the movie with Diane Keaton and Michael Douglas. I have not seen that. I was out of town. I was out of the country when that came out. The Wind Rises, which is Hayao Miyazaki's quote-unquote final movie about an airplane designer in Japan. If I Stay, a pretty boring movie about a girl who is deciding whether or not to die after a car crash. Automata, which is an interesting enough movie, sort of an iRobot, a Spanish version of iRobot. And then Housebound, which is a great film from New Zealand, a weird sort of haunted house movie. It's a horror comedy, but it's takes its comedy very seriously. So it doesn't play like a comedy necessarily. It just has some very funny moments. Stinger of the week is Into the Storm. Found footage. There we go. And that's why it's terrible. Next week, Turkey Day is coming up, and we're going to be having early releases of Horrible Bosses 2 and the Penguins of Madagascar. I will be talking to you next weekend, stuffed with turkey, with my system full of tryptophan. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.